This is the Bird Hugger Podcast with Katherine Greenleaf, the podcast for people who love birds.
Welcome to the Bird Hugger Podcast. I'm Katherine Greenleaf, and I'm so glad to be with you. I'm on board for a full 30 minutes of talking all things birds and restoring native habitat.
What happens when a burnt-out college professor living in New England decides to become a wildlife rescuer and rehabilitator? Find out on Bird Hugger, the podcast for people who love birds. Join host Katherine Greenleaf, who has been rehabilitating injured wildlife for 20 years, and hear how you can turn your backyard into a native oasis for birds.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 100th episode of the Bird Hugger Podcast. Because it's a special episode, we wanted to dedicate today's show to Flocko, the beautiful Eurasian eagle owl who stole the hearts of millions of New Yorkers. Flocko, released from his cage by vandals at the Central Park Zoo, escaped to the streets of New York City. To the utter amazement of New Yorkers and zoo officials, Flocko taught himself to hunt and survive for just over a year before being felled by what is presumed to be a collision with a glass window and ingestion of rat poison. Today, we speak with the experts surrounding Flocko's brave journey and what can be done to prevent further injury to birds from glass. Our first guest is Catherine Quayle, social media director from the Wild Bird Fund, the bird rehabilitation center that rescued Flocko on that fateful day of February 23rd. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. If you are enjoying this show and like what we do, please help us out by subscribing or following us on your favorite app to access our free show. That way you'll get notified of what's coming, you'll never miss a show, and it will help us in the ratings. And now I'd like to welcome Catherine Quayle to the show. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Catherine. It's great to be back.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you back on the show. It's sad that it's the same topic of the dangers of windows and buildings, but sort of with a twist this time around. We're going to talk about Flocko, the beloved owl of New York City. So could you tell us about Flocko and his journey over the last year or so?
Sure. I don't know a lot of Flocko's journey from firsthand knowledge, but I certainly have followed his adventures around the city, so I can tell you what I do know. It was, I guess, a little over a year ago that someone tweeted at the Wild Bird Fund saying there's an owl on the sidewalk in Midtown near the Plaza Hotel. They sent a photo. It was quite late at night, and I thought, oh gosh, who are we going to find at this time of night? And I contacted the NYPD via their Twitter feed, because there's one precinct there that is very good on Twitter, and they responded immediately. In the time that it took for them to respond, I passed the photo around among our staff, and suddenly everyone realized this is not a native owl. This is obviously an owl that's been escaped, that's escaped from somewhere. And in the time that the police attempted and failed to catch him, everyone realized who the owl was, where the owl had come from. So for the first 2 weeks, apparently, Flocko did not eat. It was unclear what was going to happen to him. The zoo made several attempts to catch him, but were not successful. And he was just kind of hanging around in Central Park and did not really give us a lot of indication that he was going to be able to survive. But then one day he started hunting. He was seen eating a rat. And after that, was able to sustain himself primarily by eating rats. And while that was a good thing, we certainly did not have a lot of hope that at some point he was not going to suffer the effects of rodenticide or something else in the city that he was not used to having to deal with, such as cars, windows, buildings, all kinds of things in the city. And he didn't fly very well initially. He had to build up his flight strength. So, but for a year, he was apparently doing great and was seen around the park and was seen in various parts of the Upper West Side. At one point, he went down to the East Village. He seemed to be kind of exploring, maybe looking for a mate. It's unclear what he was doing. So it was really pretty incredible that he lasted as long as he did, honestly. However, last, I guess it was 2 or 3 weeks ago now, on a Saturday afternoon, we received messages and phone calls saying that Flacco was in a courtyard of an apartment building on the Upper West Side, and he was lying face down, and he had fallen. Someone had actually witnessed the fall, or I think it was actually the security camera that witnessed the fall, and he was alive, but did not look good. The only good thing was that it was 2 blocks from the clinic, so we were able to quickly send a couple of our staff members, and they found him lying unresponsive. He was face down. He had not moved. And they did not believe he was alive, but they weren't sure. So they carefully wrapped him in a towel and brought him back to the clinic, where, unfortunately, he turned out to, in fact, be deceased.
So sad.
So sad. It was really unexpected, even though it's not surprising. It was unexpected on that particular day. And we certainly never thought we would see him in the clinic. We hoped we'd never see him in the clinic. So yeah, it was a very upsetting and somber evening for everyone involved.
I'm sure it was. So can you tell us, why was Flacco so beloved by so many people in New York City? What was it about him?
Well, I think there are probably a lot of reasons. The simplest is that he's a big, beautiful owl who happened to be released into Central Park, which probably has the highest population of bird photographers anywhere in the world. So there was a waiting group of paparazzi there to follow his every move, and they did. And some people posted very beautiful photos. Many people posted very beautiful photos of him. And so he was well documented. He was all over the internet. But more than that, there was a feeling that, you know, he had an unlikely case for survival in that situation, having never been free, having always lived his life in the same spot, having never hunted, having never really flown much, we've been told. So when he kind of started to make it work, it was pretty exciting. It was pretty inspirational. And I think everyone who's come to New York can feel that way, that, you know, the odds are kind of against you, but if you make it work, it's pretty great. And I think a lot of people related to that. And he was just so gorgeous. I mean, he was really just a beautiful, beautiful creature that most people don't get to see that often in the city. Even the native owls that we have, they're very secretive, obviously, and they're hard to see. So most people don't get the opportunity to have an owl regularly sitting in a tree where they can go see him on a daily basis.
And I understand at one point he started hooting once it got dark, and people would follow the sound of his hooting to.
Exactly. He was hooting. He was very vocal in the last few months, I guess, of his life. So that was exciting for the watchers. I don't know if it was exciting for him. I can't say what he was going through or why he was making so many vocalizations, but it was very exciting for the people watching him.
And I understand there's been an outpouring of love from the people of New York City. There have been candles and stuffed animals and letters and drawings by children left at a site in memory of him.
Yes, there was a tree that he was regularly seen at in Central Park, and it became a memorial. And they actually hosted a memorial last weekend, I believe, where lots and lots of people turned out. There were songs, there were poems, people gave speeches. I was not personally there, but I watched some of the video, and everyone who was there said it was very moving. Several members of our staff went. And he was really loved.
And I understand someone wants to create a bronze statue to Flacco.
Yes, we've heard that. That's been a proposal. We don't know how feasible that will be or whether the parks will go for it, but we've seen that going around.
We don't have all the information yet about the actual cause of death, or apparently there is some suggestion there were multiple causes of death. I think the necropsy has been finished, but the blood tests have not come in yet, as of this date anyway.
Right.
So
what I can tell you is that during the initial exam that our team did when he was brought into the clinic, he presented with injuries that seemed consistent with having collided with a window and falling. He had an eye injury. He had wounds to his body from the fall. But he did not show other significant signs of, for example, rodenticide, which usually presents itself in really clear ways if it's quite advanced. That doesn't mean he didn't have any rodenticide poisoning. And I think we would be very surprised if he did not, because there really was no reason for him to be colliding with a window in that particular place where he was. There may have been something else that caused his fall. But typically when a raptor has a fall like that or collides with a window, there is another underlying issue that has caused them to be off their game. And that can be rodenticide often. It could be lead poisoning. It could be an infection such as trichomoniasis that has weakened them. I don't think they found that in the necropsy though. So from what we read, the necropsy that the Wildlife Conservation Society did, he had sustained an injury to his body from the fall. They did not find signs of head trauma, but that does not mean he did not collide with the window. Many birds die after colliding that don't die from the head trauma. They might just die from the fall or something else. And probably when they do the toxicology test, they will find something, but we don't know.
Right. So we'll just have to wait for the results. So since we're on the subject now of the dangers of windows and buildings for birds, could we talk about that for a moment? Could tell our listeners, I know we've talked about it before, but of course this is in a different context.
Right.
Just how dangerous they really are to birds.
Yes. Unfortunately, our very basic windows do pose a serious hazard to birds. It's listed as either the first or second leading cause of death for migratory birds. And the problem is that birds do not see glass. They do not understand glass. So even if there's a frame around the window or there's a building, the glass part of the window shows a reflection usually of the sky or of the trees in front of it. And the bird only understands that that is a space they can fly through to get to the trees or to get to the sky. So pretty much any window can be a hazard. One of the reasons that it's very bad here in New York City is that we are on the Atlantic Flyway, which is an ancient migratory pathway that birds have been following for millennia. And the city was not here when they started that path, but they continue flying. Birds are attracted to light. So the city puts out a very bright glow and the birds are drawn to it. And so many, many birds come into the city. It's called a migrant trap because they're funneled in. And the habitat here, while quite good for such a big city, is still relatively small compared to, you know, many more rural areas. And so they're very concentrated in the parks and in areas like downtown Manhattan, where there are a lot of really tall, bright buildings that draw them in. And there are some trees scattered among those buildings. So you get a lot of migrants coming into that area. But then when they start foraging, when the sun comes up and they start foraging, they're surrounded by these huge glass walls everywhere. And so it's just a terrible combination of factors. The skyscrapers themselves are not necessarily the problem. People think, oh, it's skyscrapers they're colliding with. But it's really primarily an issue of light with the skyscrapers, the amount of light they put out. Most of the collisions happen during the day and on the lower level windows.
Right. And I understand, you know, just staying with the skyscrapers for a minute, that because the lights do attract them, and many songbirds migrate at night, it can split a flock apart. It can send them in different directions. It can cause a lot of confusion and disorientation. And yes, while they might survive that and find a tree to roost for the night, what finishes them off, as you were saying, unfortunately, is the just miasma of glass. Yes. And the newer the building, the more highly reflective the glass. It really seems to be a death trap for birds.
Yes, that's true. And unfortunately, the trend toward bigger windows, more reflective windows, so many new buildings going up that have this essentially glass and cement architecture, that has not improved the situation, I'm sure.
Right. So tell us now, what can your average citizen do to prevent birds from flying into glass?
Well, if you live in a, if you have a home or an apartment that you own and you have access to your own windows, it's, there's a lot of things that you can do. The key is the bird needs to see the window as a barrier and not as a place they can fly through. So the best way to do that is by putting small markings all over the window. And that often is little dots or stripes. They could be patterns, even an insect screen. An insect screen is perfect, but often windows don't have them anymore for some reason. So that makes it, that exacerbates the problem. But the idea is that you put something on the outside of the window so that the bird sees it as an area they can't fly through. And if you do it well, that pattern might only cover a small percentage of the window total. So you can still see out of it quite well, but it's protected from birds.
Right. So if you can break up the reflection, mm-hmm. you can dissuade a bird from looking at it as open airspace.
Right, exactly. But the key is those markings do have to be fairly close together. They've done a lot of studies and found that the best spacing is 2 by 2 inches because a bird, these birds are very small. They're, some of them are 3.5 inches and they will see a 5 or 6 inch gap and they think they can fly right through it. So if you just, you know, put a couple of stickers on the window, which is what the old thinking was, that really doesn't work. It's been proven very ineffective, unfortunately.
Now, I understand there's pending legislation in New York City for bird safe windows, which they're thinking of renaming, calling it the Flocko Law. Is
well,
that
there's
correct?
There's a couple of things. There was actually a law passed in New York City that relates to the windows specifically a few years ago and has now come into effect. And it affects new buildings and buildings that do a substantial retrofit of the external glass. So those buildings are required to use bird-friendly materials. In other words, fritted glass or glass that has markings on it or some other design feature that makes it so that the window is safe from birds. We've seen a few of those. The new wing at the Natural History Museum, beautiful center is all bird safe. That glass is all has a pattern on it and it's just gorgeous. You can't even see the pattern. And hopefully we'll be seeing a lot more of that. But there are attempts to also legislate the light pollution during migration. And that, I believe, is the law that they want to, or the bill, I should say, that they want to rename after Flocko. So what that would do would be to regulate the amount of light that buildings can emit during migration, or really require buildings to cut way back on their unnecessary lighting during migration. I don't know exactly what is happening with that right now, so I can't talk too much about that legislation, but we are hoping to see some progress in that area this year.
I think, you know, just staying on that topic, people become confused when they hear that we want them to turn the lights off, especially in taller buildings or all buildings, but especially taller buildings. People think, oh, well, won't the birds not see the buildings and fly into them? I don't think they realize how high up birds migrate at night.
Right.
And it's the lights that draw them down towards the skyscrapers and the other buildings.
Right, exactly.
They fly thousands of feet above land.
Mm-hmm.
So turning and dimming the lights can only help them.
Yes, exactly. I think it's very unusual for a bird to just, you know, fly right into a dark building. I doubt that happens very often.
Now we lose close to 1 billion birds a year between spring and fall migration from birds flying into windows. What, in your opinion, is the reason why? We've done brainstorming on the show with experts. I'd like to get your take on why people seem to not be grasping the import of shielding birds from their windows.
I think there's still a lot of public education that needs to be done. Amazingly, this is something I talk about all the time, and yet it astonishes me to continue to hear people who don't know that this issue exists and that don't really understand that it's such a big problem. I think one of the problems is that many of these birds you never see. The problem is not visible to most people. You may, if you have a home and you have a garden, you may occasionally hear a bird hitting your window, but the bird flies off. And so people think, oh, it's fine. The bird is fine. It's probably not fine. That's the the unfortunate thing, is that most birds will sustain some injury, and some of those injuries will not be survivable even when they do fly off. But, you know, people think, oh, a bird hits the window. That's just what birds do. There's nothing I can do about that. But the enormity of the problem is not visible on a day-to-day basis to most people, unless you're someone who is involved in the issue and you're out, you know, looking for them, collecting them. In some cases, it might just be a bird here and there, but those birds add up to a huge number, you know. And these huge collision events that happen, we have them occasionally, you know, down in the World Trade Center. And there was that terrible incident that happened in Chicago last year where 1,000 birds were killed in one night at one building. When those things happen, then people suddenly understand the enormity of the problem, because you have this one event that really brings it to light. But otherwise, it's kind of invisible to most people.
And there seems to be a disconnect, at least from what I'm seeing, between the media reports of these huge events where hundreds of birds are killed and your average homeowner who has, you know, a dozen windows on their house, but still is not doing anything to protect birds from the glass.
Right. Again, I think you have a few birds hit your kitchen window and you think it's just a small problem. It's not a big deal. But statistically, those small buildings are causing many more deaths than these huge convention centers like the one in Chicago. I mean, that one is an egregious example, but you know, these big events are not really what's causing that 1 billion number. It's the, you know, bird after bird, home after home. And it's also, it's an aesthetic thing. Everyone wants these big plate glass windows now. And, you know, the idea of putting something on the outside of your window might feel like you're somehow diminishing your view, your property, the look of your home. If more people were doing it and it became more common, I think it could catch on and lots of people would do it. It looks fine. In some cases, it looks great. It looks better. So hopefully it's just the ball has to get rolling a little bit more.
So it's sort of like, what will the neighbors say? They're going to think we're weird if we put dots on our windows.
Right. And it's, you know, it's similar to how there's a big resistance to planting native plants in your yard and making a more natural habitat for animals in your yard. Some cities won't even allow you to do that because they want everyone to have the same lawn. I mean, it's an aesthetic cultural shift, I think, that needs to happen.
Well, Catherine, I wanted to thank you for joining us today. The Wild Bird Fund does such marvelous work. You're just always there and always ready to help the birds of New York City. And we're so lucky that we have you there. So lucky.
Thank you. I feel lucky to have found this wonderful organization. There's just an incredible team of people there doing this work every day. And it's a really inspiring place. But thank you. I've really enjoyed this conversation, as always.
And now let's switch gears and talk to Christine Shepherd, the expert on glass safety for birds at the American Bird Conservancy.
And now I'd like to introduce Christine Shepherd to the show. Christine, it is great to have you back with us today.
Thank you.
Yep. It's to discuss the sad circumstances of Flocco. You are the person who does outreach about the danger of windows and buildings to birds for the American Bird Conservancy. Could you address that? Could you talk about, you know, here it is a spring migration now. Birds are pouring back into their northern areas to find a mate and set up a nest to raise their nestlings. What statistics can you give us about how many birds are killed or harmed flying into windows and buildings?
The best numbers we have at the moment are more than a billion birds killed and injured every year just in the United States from flying into buildings. And that's because glass is everywhere. And birds are flying everywhere. So whenever birds encounter glass, there's the risk of collisions, which is what happened to Flocco the owl.
So what, in your mind, is a way to reduce glass collisions?
There are a lot of things that people can do to the windows that they control, essentially, that they have access to. It essentially involves putting something on the glass that birds will interpret as a barrier. So if you think about birds flying towards a tree with a lot of branches, they're going to be looking to see if they can go between those branches. Well, you get the same effect if you put an array of dots on a piece of glass. The birds see the dots as obstacles, and if the dots are 2 inches apart, for example, the birds will think they can't fly between them. So they'll change their course and they'll fly away.
So 2 inches is the magic number. Anything wider than that, and the birds will try to fly in between them.
Well, 2 inches is the magic number for the smallest bird. So we want to make glass safe for hummingbirds, for magnolia warblers, and so forth. And if we do make glass safe for those little songbirds, it's also safe for hawks and pigeons and larger birds.
Now, what if a person had an unlimited budget? What would be the Cadillac alternative for windows?
There really isn't a single solution. And what solution you use depends on where you are, what your climate is like. The most effective solutions are solutions that have markings on the outside surface of the glass, which means that a reflection can't obscure them. But you can make those markings out of, you can etch them, you can make them out of ceramic dots, you can make them out of different kinds of coatings and so forth. So there are a lot, and you can apply materials to the surface of existing glass. So even if you have glass that isn't bird friendly, there are products that you can get and apply to the glass that don't have to really obscure your view, you know, that will make birds avoid it.
Right. And I've heard of people who, you know, with a limited budget, using tempera paints, having the children paint the outside of the glass with tempera paints, or even using ivory soap.
I'm a huge fan of paint. It can last. I've put paint on some of my own windows. It's lasted over a year. But at the same time, it's non-toxic. It's very easy to take off if you don't want it there anymore. And yeah, if you're working with kids, you can do a different design on the window for every holiday.
Yeah, that's actually a great idea. Just as we wrap up here, what can your average citizen do if you were to bundle up a list of things that people could do to protect birds from hitting glass or buildings?
You can very directly retrofit your glass. You can turn out lights at night and try to convince everybody around you to do the same thing. You can talk to your legislators about potentially sponsoring legislation or supporting legislation that would require new buildings to use bird-friendly design strategies. You can also support legislation that would require larger scale turnoff of lights, especially during spring and fall migration.
Those are all excellent suggestions. So, well, Christine, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I realize it's under sad circumstances because of Flacco, but perhaps some good can come of his death. Perhaps more people are interested in helping birds.
I think it has definitely increased awareness of the issue, and that's important.
Yeah. Well, good to talk to you again.
Nice to see you again.
And finally, we have New York State Senator Brad Hoylman Siegel to talk to us about the renewed push for legislation to protect birds from glass and nighttime lighting.
Senator, welcome to the show. We're so glad to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Could you please tell our listeners about the Bird Safe Building Act and what it would do to help birds?
Well, there's a federal version of the Bird Safe Buildings Act, which would require new or remodeled government buildings to use materials shown to reduce collisions. And we'd like to institute that at the state level. So our legislation would require any new or significantly altered state buildings to incorporate bird-friendly designs, particularly as it pertains to their windows. It would apply to state-owned and, where possible, state-leased buildings. And it would direct the commissioner up here in Albany for the General Services Organization to work with the Department of Environmental Conservation to develop bird-safe building design guidelines and identify best practices for reducing bird collisions, and to update these every 5 years.
And is it true what I was told? It may be named the Flacco Act in honor of Flacco.
We literally renamed the bill and from the Bird Safe Buildings Act to the Flacco Act, which we came up with a what we thought was a witty acronym at the time, Feathered Lives Also Count, because we know that Flacco was such a touch point for so many New Yorkers and many who visited our city, in particular Central Park. You know, nature sometimes is shocking to witness in a city as urban as ours, but when it happens, it's magical. And that's what Flacco and other birds, particularly birds of prey, bring to the general public. When you see a red-tailed hawk soar over Washington Square Park, as I often do, or hear sightings of falcons underneath the Manhattan Bridge, it sparks curiosity, enjoyment, and appreciation for the natural world.
Right. And I hear you also have a second piece of legislation, the Dark Skies Protection Act.
Yes, and that's certainly a more substantive bill, I think, because it really goes to the heart of a perennial problem in large cities like New York, which is the migratory patterns of birds are often thrown off course due to light pollution. Certainly, New York City has a lot of lights. Let's just start with Times Square and proceed from that vantage point. But our bill would require most non-essential outdoor lighting to be covered by an external shield. It might be motion activated, or otherwise it would have to be extinguished between 11 p.m. and 5 a.m. This is modeled after legislation that's in effect in New Mexico and Arizona.
That's great. It's a wonderful tribute to Flacco to have the act named after him. And it's possible that some good may come from his tragic situation.
I would hope so. You know, we have to remember that Flacco was also the victim of a vandal who cut his netting and allowed him to escape. That person has never been found. But it was also so sad that such a magnificent creature met its end in such a tragic, avoidable fashion, such as hitting a glass pane window.
Right. Well, Senator, I want to thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for your interest in advocacy on these issues. You know, I sometimes hear from critics that, you know, Albany or other state legislature shouldn't be spending their time on matters they consider trivial, like wildlife. But I think they could not be more wrong. I think it's our responsibility to protect the natural environment for my daughters and future generations of New Yorkers.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you for the awesome work you're doing.
Thank you. Very happy to do it.
Join Americans everywhere in the One Third for the Birds movement. Dedicate the back third of your yard to birds and other wildlife. Make this area a quiet zone with no leaf blowers or lawnmowers. Plant native trees and shrubs so birds have plenty of insects to eat. Create a safe haven for birds to nest and raise their young. You will be rewarded with many hours of bird watching fun. For more information on One Third for the Birds, go to the Bird Hugger page on Facebook.
And that's it for today's episode, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Have a great week and enjoy the birds. Bye for now.